This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Maintaining bone strength is complex with no single solution. My patients who want to optimize their bone health have seen remarkable results with LiveMD as part of a comprehensive bone program. LiveMD is a Class 1 medical device cleared by the FDA. It creates a gentle, low-intensity vibration to benefit your musculoskeletal system. It's a safe, scientifically proven, and simple approach to maintaining musculoskeletal health and wellness. It really works, just 10 minutes per day. Go to livemd.us, that's livemd.us, to learn more about how LiveMD may improve your health. That's livemd.us. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today I think we have something quite unique for you because often we talk about food and diets in terms of, what's the right diet? Is it a paleo diet? Is it the salad and salmon diet? Is it a vegetarian or vegan diet? What's the right diet? But this is a book that kind of transcends that argument because you can go on and on, gluten-free, meat-free, is it sugar, is it fat, what's the culprit that's causing us to become sick and obese in epidemic proportions. The book is entitled The Dorito Effect, The Surprising New Truth About Food and Flavor, and it really goes to the heart of the question, why do we overeat? Why are we having problems in the 20th and 21st centuries that our ancestors were not prey to? The author is Mark Schatzker. He's an award-winning food journalist. He's the author of Steak, One Man's Search for the World's Tastiest Piece of Beef. I got a note to self. I got to get that book. He's also written for the New York Times and recently appeared in op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. He's also a radio columnist for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and writes frequently for other newspapers and publications. He's got a website, markschatzker.com. Check it out. It's spelled S-C-H-A-T-Z-K-E-R. Mark, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
And, of course, you've been doing a whirlwind media tour on this. The book is just out, and already you appeared on CBS this morning, correct?
Yes.
So the book is entitled The Dorito Effect. And so why single out the Dorito? What is it about the Dorito that really epitomizes what you're trying to get across in this book?
No, it's a great question, and you phrased it very well, because this book is not a screed against Doritos, and I'm not arguing that Doritos are our downfall. Doritos tell us so much about what has happened to food, and I want to tell you quickly the story of how the Dorito came to be, because
sure,
it's very informative and very illuminating. The Dorito was invented by a guy named Arch West, and initially he was in California with his family, and he ate at a Mexican restaurant, and he ate tortilla chips for the first time, and he thought, this is going to be the next big thing for Frito-Lay. Over the course of many years, he developed the tortilla chip concept. He came up with a great catchy name, which meant little pieces of gold in sort of a pidgin Mexican Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And they launched, Frito-Lay launched the Dorito, and it bombed. It was just a salted tortilla chip, and in the Southwest, where there was a Hispanic cultural influence and people knew you could dip a tortilla chip into guacamole or salsa or a bean dip, it did okay. But everywhere else, they didn't really get it. And they thought, well, this snack sounds Mexican. It doesn't taste Mexican. And it almost got canned. But they came back to Arch West, and they said, well, what do we do now? And he said, let's make it taste like taco. And the reason they could make it taste like taco is because about 10 years earlier, there had been breakthroughs that had been building for many years in flavor technology. And it was now possible, using essentially pure chemicals, to make a corn chip taste like whatever you want. You could give it the savory, satisfying notes of a taco. After that, they brought out nacho cheese. And that is what made the Dorito the smashing success that it is. Flavoring incentivized people to eat a chip that they weren't all that interested in eating. And so it's just a
bland piece of corn flour, you know, which is inherently kind of bland taste.
A tortilla chip, which, you know, fine. I mean, I you know, you can graze on a few tortilla chips, but usually you kind of want to dip it in something. It needs something, which is why we often have guacamole or salsa, which you could say are enhancing its nutrition because you're dipping it in vegetables and things like that. But with the Dorito, all of a sudden you didn't need that. You could create the illusion of other food without having that food. And that is the model to which all food now aspires. We used to sprinkle flavorings on a handful of snacks. Now they're everywhere, and they're not just in junk food. There's flavorings in soy milk. There's flavorings in pasta sauce. There's flavorings in yogurt. There's flavorings in herbal tea. They're everywhere. Now, the other thing that's happening, on the one hand, we're incentivizing eating very often the wrong food. At the same time, whole foods, the stuff we should be eating, the tomatoes, the chicken, the cucumber, the grapes, this stuff is all getting blander and blander. It's getting less and less exciting to eat. So here we are. We all know we should be eating more whole foods, but what tastes better? Because the one point I will make is that humans are drawn to deliciousness. It is our number one instinct is to eat, and we understand eating through the language of flavor. So very simply, if you look at what we've done to flavor, you'll understand everything that's happened to food, and in turn, happened to us and our bodies.
Well, you know, the instinct to go for flavorful foods is very ancient. It's in our genes. But how did this get perverted and distorted so that we are, on the one hand, paradoxically malnourished, but on the other hand, overnourished and obese?
Yes. Well, it all had to do with the invention of a device called the gas chromatograph. The first commercial gas chromatograph went on sale in 1955. Before that, organic chemists could only wonder what it was in an orange or in a steak or a tomato that made it taste that way. These foods all contain macronutrients, the things we always talk about like starch or protein, carbohydrates, but those things have nothing to do with flavor. The flavor experience is brought about by chemicals. They're called volatile organic compounds. It's vapor, essentially. It's you appreciate it in your nose. Even when you're chewing something in your mouth, your nose is sensing a great deal. And these chemicals exist in minute quantities, and no one ever knew what they were, with a handful of exceptions. Then in walks the gas chromatograph, and all of a sudden, you can put an orange through a gas chromatograph, you can put a steak, a tomato, a grape, anything you want, and you can find out exactly what those chemicals are. Well, it doesn't take very long before you're producing them in factories and then adding them to whatever you want. And that's how we make soft drinks. That's how we make junk food. That's why we can flavor things, because we cracked nature's language of flavor.
But it's not nice to fool with Mother Nature, because the flavors in the past were the signature of important nutrients, not just vitamins and minerals, but the hundreds and thousands of chemicals, the polyphenols, the various plant substances that nourished us. And now we can simulate them, but we can't duplicate them in terms of their nutritional value.
Exactly. I call it nutritional decapitation. When you take a tomato and slice off the flavors, you create the experience of a tomato, and you can add that to a pasta sauce or a potato chip or a canned soup. You create that thrilling experience of tomato, but you don't back it up with the nutrition that a tomato brings you. There was a study a few years ago in Science, perhaps the most prestigious scientific journal, which found that the flavors in a tomato, there's about 400 of these flavor compounds in a tomato, and humans are only interested in 20 of them. All the rest are kind of noise to us. Our brain essentially blocks them out. And the 20 that we're most interested in are all inextricably linked to nutrients. Basically, what we like about a tomato is its nutrition. And when we start to play with that, when we take those flavorings and put them wherever we want, we're really messing around the way our brain understands food and meets its own needs. So I think this is very powerful technology that's really getting us into a bad situation.
Wait, do you think that there's a biological mismatch now because, you know, we're getting foods that go directly to certain pleasure centers in our brain without allowing us to put the brakes on? You know, we just put on the feedback
exactly.
And we can't stop.
I think that's exactly what's happening. we're creating food that's kind of telling a nutritional lie. If you take the flavor of orange, for example, the flavor of orange is indicative of all those great things that are in citrus, vitamins, antioxidants, fiber, minerals. When you take just the orange flavoring and add it to a soft drink, the soft drink tastes like orange. A kid drinks it and thinks, oh, this is great. You've got not only none of the nutrition, you're hitting them with a massive wallop of sugar. What does that do over time? On one instance, you're fooling yourself, but what does that do to your body and your brain over a lifetime of consumption? One of the things that's really interesting that I looked into was food addiction. There's some fascinating neuroscience around food addiction, and the most interesting thing, most slender people judge the obese. They think they can't control themselves. They just like food too much. But the most interesting thing about food addiction, and we know this from fMRI brain scans, is that food addicts don't actually like food more than, you know, let's say normal people. They crave it more. They're locked into a very destructive cycle of craving food, and their cravings can't be met by actual food. It's like they're not getting what they need. And this is the problem with modern food, is that you end up setting up a kind of a ruinous cycle of craving and overeating and never being satisfied.
So the foods are, the flavorings are, create sort of a Trojan horse phenomenon to allow you to imbibe a food that is nowhere equivalent to its the natural thing it's supposed to replicate, and that brings in your body these enemy warriors that wreak destruction on your system.
Yeah, and calories, lots and lots of calories. And we see that, literally, we can see that in how our bodies have changed over the last 50 years. You know, if you think about it with a potato chip, let's think, they often put flavorings, and they'll put something like MSG, which is the flavor of umami, and in nature is considered kind of an indicator for protein. Umami is considered the taste of protein. Well, let's think about that. You put these flavorings on a chip that make it taste meaty and roasty. You add some MSG, and you've got the crunchiness of the chip. You put in salt. You've created something that tastes quite salty. We'd call that a salty snack, a savory snack. Usually, it's only meat that tastes that way. But we've now created, you know, fried little slices of carbs, very high calorie,
right,
fat carbs, with no meat. What signal are we sending?
Yeah, we're playing sort of it's almost like they're playing expert musical chemistry in our brains. And these are people who,
yes,
really understand food technology and what's going to appeal, because, you know, the incentive is not proper nutrition, the incentive is to sell more product.
And it works. It works really well. We've known that for a long time. And the models out of animal science are very compelling. We know we can do this with animals, with insects, with mammals. You can get them to eat essentially whatever you want by fooling them with flavors. It's very effective.
Well, you know, you in order for this to work, two things need to happen, as you said earlier. On the one hand, we're jazzing foods, you know, revving them up with artificial flavors and appealing textures and sweetness and saltiness and all the properties that appeal to us. But at the same time, another phenomenon is occurring, which is the foods that we used to rely upon are becoming bereft of flavor. And you cite, very interestingly, the example of the chicken, which, you know, a lot of oldsters say, you know, I remember in the old days, chicken used to taste like chicken. And then you kind of go, yeah, you know, that person is just having sort of a nostalgic view towards their childhood. But actually, in the book, you document how this happened.
Yes. And perhaps some of the nostalgia when it comes to cars or government being better, maybe that is pure nostalgia, but there is no question that chicken has changed radically. We have cranked up the output of chicken in a way that is almost mind-boggling. Chickens grow about three times faster than they used to, let's say in the late 1940s. They sit indoors. They eat what's called a high-energy diet. They get big really quickly, and we kill them as giant babies. If we didn't kill them when we killed them, they'd develop metabolic disease and die on their own. Chicken meat has absolutely no flavor for two reasons. One is that these are big babies, and babies never really have much flavor. That's why veal is so much milder than beef. That's why lamb is so much milder than mutton. And all chicken today, back in the day, a fryer or a broiler was considered milder than a roaster. They're all broilers now. There's no such thing as a roaster or boiling fowl anymore. The other thing, meat gets its flavor by what it eats. If you
you are what you eat, not just you are what you eat eats, actually.
Absolutely. Dairy cattle, if you let them graze in the onion patch, will produce milk that tastes oniony. They are what they eat, and they taste like what they eat. Well, chickens today are basically eating high-output soybeans and corn, so not only are they giant babies, they're eating feed that is utterly flavorless. Chicken doesn't taste like anything anymore. The proof comes in looking at recipes. If you look at a recipe for chicken from the 1920s for, let's say, fried chicken, there was no buttermilk back then. They didn't make this big crust. They just salt and pepper, dredged it in flour, and shallow fried it. And if you tried it with a chicken now, there's no way you'd be able to eat it. It would taste like a roll of wet toilet paper. If you look at recipes
I've done that. I bought plain broiled chicken breasts, and, you know, very virtuously, I've sauteed them in a little bit of olive oil with maybe a little salt and pepper, and it's like, forget about it.
You can't do it. It's amazing when you look at when really good chefs come out with recipes for fried chicken. You have to brine the chicken for an entire day. There's like 12 ingredients in the brine. And then in the batter, you add cayenne pepper, you add garlic, you add onion, you add thyme, rosemary, sage, lemon zest. We're just barraging things with flavorings because chicken has gotten so bland. It's also interesting now that fried chicken has this thick crust. Back in the day, it was just dredged in little flour. It was a very minor crust. You're really eating the chicken. Now we essentially put this Dorito-like shell around our chicken. And really, that's the only good thing about fried chicken. When you get beyond the skin and actually have to start eating the meat, it's actually kind of hard to eat.
Well, that's why there's this apocryphal story of the rat who fell into the vat at Kentucky Fried Chicken, and people, you know, just ate it because it's the coating that's really the flavor in the chicken.
It is the coating. But what I found so interesting about that, because I essentially commissioned a farmer to grow me some heirloom chickens, and I eat fried chicken the way it was eaten 60 or 80 years ago, and I was blown away. It was like a Proustian experience. You're almost
crying. You had a chicken epiphany, did you describe in the book. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, a friend of mine got some of these chickens from a Mennonite hatchery. He grew them on his farm. They lived outside. It was amazing to watch these chickens eat. They'd rove around the farmyard. They'd catch frogs. They killed a snake once. They'd eat the grass down. They would literally mow the lawn. When we killed one, you could see its crop was full of grass. The fat inside was a rich yellow, which is carotenoids. I had the omega-3s tested by a nutritionist. They were terrific. So a nutritionally a totally different bird. But that said, it was a very different bird to look at. It didn't look like a chicken. It looked like a dead bird. The skin was yellow. It was much smaller. The breast wasn't nearly as full. The thing was only 2.5 pounds after 12 or 13 weeks.
Right.
So this is a more expensive chicken to raise. And then when we ate it, it's funny, we had some unexpected guests. Of course, my wife and I invite them in for dinner, and I'm sitting going, I got like a 2.5 pound chicken here. There's no way we're feeding four people. Right. So I bought extra corn, and I made all these other things. It turns out everyone said to a person it was the best chicken they'd ever eaten, and yet there was leftover chicken because this chicken was so delicious. But it was so satisfying that at a certain point you were done. You don't feel this need to keep shoving it in your mouth.
So you're saying that the natural foods have more satiety value, which is actually a natural break on overeating.
That's right. And listen, we already know this because think about something like peaches. I love peaches. When you get a great basket of peaches, you can bite into it and you're in heaven. How many peaches can you really eat? Do you sit there and polish off the entire basket and sit there in a state of regret going, oh, I can't believe I did that? That could never happen. After about the second peach, you just go, that was amazing. I'm done. And you don't have another peach till the next day. And that real foods put the brakes on eating. We've created now, interestingly, after I ate that heirloom chicken, I went down to Memphis and went to one of those really famous fried chicken restaurants. And I couldn't stop eating, yet in my head the whole time I'm going, this is nowhere near as good as the chicken I had 3 weeks ago. But I can't stop eating it.
Exactly. Well, it's all the addictive stuff that they put into it. It's hard to put it down. Your wife actually helped you coin a term, which is great. It's in the book. It's called McRegret. McRegret. Tell us about that.
McRegret. McRegret is the state literally of regret, what a scientist would call dysphoria, the opposite of pleasure, despite the kind of the brain fog, the nausea, and the regret that you feel after eating a meal that just does not sit with you properly. And this is something that happens to me. I don't eat a lot of junk food. I'm not into the purity of body, and I try not to be a judgmental person. I just don't like junk food, and I don't like the way, especially, it makes me feel now. But every now and again, you're stuck in an airport or you're on a road trip, and you got to go there. And what I find so interesting is that as I start to eat it, I get excited. The aromas remind me of eating this food when I was a kid. As I eat it, I sort of it's actually not nearly as good as I thought. And then afterwards, there's this state of regret of, I just don't feel great right now. This happens when I eat potato chips. It happens when I eat junk food. It happens when I eat cheap pizza. I don't like the way I feel. And I know lots of people that feel this way. And I think there's an awful lot of people that feel this way all the time.
Well, you know, it's the equivalent of a hangover. It's a food hangover. And, you know, all have that referent, you know, if we had a few too many drinks, or those of us who were smokers, you know, went through a pack of Camels, and they tasted or seemed to taste good at the time, but the aftermath is devastating.
Yeah, and listen, I mean, at least the thing about drinking is we all know it's a toxin and it's an indulgence. The hangover is expected. Food isn't supposed to do that.
Right. Exactly. That's the point.
And, you know, I first noticed it when I did that book about steak. I ate an awful lot of very heavily corn-fed, really fatty steaks, and you had to go sit down afterwards. You almost felt like you had to put those, like, the paddles on your heart like they do in cardiac surgery.
Right.
But what I found was really interesting is I started to eat grass-fed beef, and it was like you felt the same way you did after eating sushi. You know, it was delicious. You ate a full meal, but you could get up and go for a walk. Mm-hmm. You had a spring in your step. You weren't sort of shut down by what you ate. And that's really important to me. As I get older, I really need to, I want my food to make me feel good.
Well, absolutely. Well, this is a good point at which to pause because for our listening audience, you're used to this. We divide our podcast into two parts. Our discussion is about a great new book. I really advise you getting it. The Dorito Effect, The Surprising New Truth About Food and Flavor. The author, Mark Schatzker, is our guest today. And we're going to return with more of a focus on how we can overcome this trend. Is it hopeless? Are we moving towards food Armageddon because of agribusiness and the people who exploit our taste buds in the food business? We'll be right back. So please tune in to part two with Mark Schatzker. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.